one day when I was 16, I was mopping the floor for about the 300th time. And my father looked at me over the bar and said, you know, someday this will all be yours.
Were you like, I don't think so?
Under my breath, I said, dear God, I got to get plan B.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, the issues parents face when their gay child comes out. How to have an open, honest, and ongoing conversation.
Next, an insider's look at what it takes to become a great writer and an award-winning author.
It's time to create more space on your bucket list. An update on 1,000 places to see before you die.
Plus, the art of leadership from a general who knows.
And we'll shoot the breeze about the power of mindfulness.
Coming out to family can be incredibly awkward, stomach-churning, and a huge moment in a child's life. It can also be overwhelming for the parents. Some feel blindsided, especially if a gay lifestyle conflicts with their personal beliefs, or they're worried about how the decision will impact the child's future. Parents need guidance on how to move forward in a positive way.
Danielle Owens-Reed and Kristen Russo provide that in This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids, a question and answer guide to everyday life. Danielle joins us on the phone from Los Angeles to talk about the issues parents face when a child comes out. Great to have you with us, Danielle.
It's so good to be here.
So why did you feel the need to write this book?
Well, we've spent the past almost 5 years now talking with LGBTQ youth and kind of along the way, you know, talking to them online and going to their schools and seeing them at events. Almost every single time we would meet someone new, they would be like, can you make videos for our parents? Can you explain these words to our parents? Can you come out for us? Over the years, we've been trying to collect resources, but we just kind of realized that there wasn't a book that was current and that was a little more lighthearted, and that just kind of got to the point. All the other books were very somber or clinical, and they were more just like long stories about what someone else had been through, and we were like, there's got to be a way to do just straight-up advice and include some stories so you can, you know, hear from the people who have been through the same issues. So we just did it.
Well, can you tell us your coming-out story?
Absolutely. I came out when I was a sophomore in college. I started dating a girl, and about a week later, I was like, I have to tell everyone. I'm from the South, so it was a little nerve-wracking, but I was also at a liberal arts college, so I had a huge support. And when I came out to my dad, he was totally cool with it, and he just wants me to be happy. And when I came out to my mom, it was a little more complicated. At first, she was like, that's okay, because Aylin's gay, and I love Aylin, which was very convenient for me. But, you know, I think she sat with it a little bit and started to feel a lot of the feelings that parents feel, and she was afraid for me, and she didn't understand why I wanted to live this lifestyle, and she was upset that I would never be married. So it was a difficult time. But, you know, now here I am, and all I am is gay. That's all I talk about all day long. So.
Well, how did that experience, your coming out experience, really shape what you wanted parents to know?
I think that when you come out to your parents and they ask you things like, don't you want to get married? Don't you want to have kids? Don't you want to be happy and normal? As the kid, you're like, yes, I do want those things. And then you kind of think you can't have those things. And then it gets very complicated. And you're young, so you don't know how to talk about it. And so for me personally, it was answering those questions for the parents so that they didn't put their kid in a potentially, you know, damaging situation where the kid now thinks that they're not going to be able to ever be happy. So I wanted to be able to say, like, hey, instead of pressuring your kid to answer questions they don't know how to answer, we'll answer them for you.
Well, Danielle, let's paint some coming out scenarios that parents may face.
Sure.
First of all, your child announces he or she is gay at the family dinner table. And you're completely overwhelmed. You know, you're kind of blindsided. You don't know how to respond.
Yeah.
You're trying maybe choking on some soup or something. But you don't want to say the wrong thing. You love this child more than anything in your life. What should you do as a parent?
I think you say exactly what you just said. You tell them you love them, you know, and I think the questions will come and the fears will settle in. But like in that moment, especially surrounded by everyone else, I think the most important thing is to just express how much you love them and, you know, ask them if there's anything that they need from you. And then maybe later you can bring it up again and be like, you know, who knows? Do you want to talk about who we can tell? You can ask all of those questions. But I think in the moment, honestly, all anyone wants to hear when they come out to you is, I love you and I want you to be happy.
Well, say you find out accidentally that your child is gay. Not that I'm saying we snoop through their cell phones, but maybe some parents do, who knows? Or maybe their siblings kind of spill the beans.
Sure.
Should you at that point then talk to your child directly, or is it best to wait for them to come to you?
I think in most cases, it's best to wait and let them have their coming out moment. However, Kristen and I have been talking about this a lot recently because we've been dialoguing with parents and kids who the kid was like, I put that stuff out there because I wanted you to know, but I didn't know how to tell you. So I think it kind of depends on your relationship with your kid. If normally you would find something out and you'd be like, hey, I saw this in your cell phone and I want to talk to you about it, then I think that's what you could do. But if you're the kind of parent who would see something and just be like, ugh, I'll let them deal with that and then come to me when they're ready. If you saw something in your kid's backpack that was like, I have a crush on my best friend in the entire world and it's making me cry all the time, whether or not they're gay, if you would say, hey, do you want to talk about this? Then I think it's okay to do that. But if you wouldn't, then, you know, it's always better to let that kid have their coming out moment for sure.
And I also wonder if it just depends on their age. You know, there might be a difference between a 12-year-old and an 18-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really interesting. I feel like kids are coming out at younger ages now, which is pretty cool because it was not, you know, when I was in high school, there was one gay kid and he was like, no one really knew what to do with him because none of us understood what gay even was. But yeah, kids are coming out a lot younger. And I think if they know those things about themselves when they're 12, that's amazing. And hopefully, you know, they'll be ready to come out as soon as possible.
What if you have a gut feeling that your child is gay, but they haven't come out to you? I mean, should you just say, oh, by the way, I have this like feeling or
I saw this feeling or
I feel like parents often know things about their kids that we don't know about ourselves. But I'll tell you what, when my dad would confront me with stuff and be like, you know, here's the thing I know about you, I'd be like, you're wrong. Everything you say is wrong, until I hit the age where I realized my dad was right about everything. But allow them to have that moment. The best thing you can do is just have an open and warm environment in your home, you know, talking positively about shows like Glee or Modern Family or like just mentioning Ellen or anything that's going on in the media. I mean, you know, marriage equality is exploding right now, and it's totally fine to be talking about that in your home. That makes perfect sense. So I think just having an open environment where you do talk about stuff will allow that kid to feel like, oh, I'm going to be supported if I come out.
Our guest is Danielle Owens Reed, author of This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids, about issues that many families face when a child comes out. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at twoboomerbabes.com. Now back to our conversation with Danielle Owens Reed.
Now, Danielle, say your child is like 13, 14-ish, middle school to high school, and they want to come out at school. And, of course, you're concerned that they're going to be teased mercilessly or, you know, even worse. How should you advise them?
Well, I think it depends, and a lot of that has to be up to your kid. It's interesting because I think in middle school, you know, I wasn't gay in middle school, but I think we're all kind of teased. I had friends who were teased because they got good grades, and then friends who were picked on because they got bad grades, and friends who got picked on because they were too big or they were too thin or because they weren't good at sports. It's just, it's a hard time in general. And I think talking to your kid, if your kid comes out to you and they are talking about coming out at school, and asking them if they feel safe and do they have friends that have come out, and is there a GSA, a Gay Straight Alliance, at their school, and asking them questions to kind of get them to think about it, and also to make you feel a little more comfortable. Because if your kid is like, I have a group of friends who most of them came out last year and everyone loves them and it's been really great, or if they're like, you know, there are a couple of people that get picked on, but I always stand up for them. You know, I mean, it's just so interesting the way that we think about middle school versus how it is to be in middle school. And I think just having those conversations and seeing if they feel safe will let them think about it and make the right decisions and will help you feel a little more comfortable as well.
Right, because it seems like a young person could be rather impulsive and they've come out and they're very excited about this and they just want to tell everyone and you're thinking, oh my goodness, especially
for sure.
Middle school kids. Might not be as receptive. So what if we think that our child is actually being bullied at school because they've come out?
I think the first thing that you can do is, again, talk to your kid about those situations, because I think a lot of kids will be bullied or will feel really crappy at school and then they won't talk about it. And I think that that's one of the best things that you can do is show your support for your kid and talk through it with them and then ask them if there's anything they'd like you to do, because there are some kids who will not want you to talk to their administrators or teachers at all because it could make things worse. And then there are some kids who will be like, yes, can you please talk to someone? And I think talking to your kid, I feel like I'm repeating myself, and I feel like we do it a lot, but it's like having that conversation with your kid is so important. And a lot of times there are kids who are being picked on at school who, when they come home, they don't talk about it, so they don't really feel like they have a safe space. But knowing that their home is a safe space is really important. And if it's so awful that they don't want to be going to that school, I think looking into other options is a really good idea.
You know, I also imagine that a huge worry for parents of gay kids is how their child will be treated not only in school, but beyond that, throughout life.
Sure.
I mean, the world is changing, but there's still lots of discrimination out there. And,
absolutely.
You know, we don't want them to hurt. We want them to just be beautiful people that they are. So should we express our concerns to our kids about that?
I honestly think talking about everything is a great idea. So expressing those concerns are amazing. And I think that also being able to relate to your kid on some level. And, yeah, it's like your kid is gay and you are not. And so you can't say like, oh, I'm gay, I've been there. But we've all felt some sort of discrimination, you know, whether you've been treated differently because you're a woman or because of your race or because of religious beliefs. I mean, we've all felt the experience of being treated poorly because of a thing about us that was different from whoever was treating us that way. So I think being able to be like, hey, the world isn't sunshine and roses, and like, there will be people in some places that don't treat you well, and I want you to know that and to be aware and to be able to feel safe and to know that you have people to call and stuff like that. I mean, in growing up, I remember, you know, before I was gay, my dad would be like, hey, if you're going to parties, like, there might be people who don't treat you well. Just know that I'm going to have my phone on. If you don't feel safe, you can call me. And, like, knowing that made me so much more aware of my surroundings and what I was doing, and just knowing that I had an out made it so that I felt much more safe, if that makes sense.
Well, Danielle, what about telling the rest of the family, say grandparents that might, you know, be from a very different generation and, mm-hmm. and even close friends, you know, how should that be handled?
I think that, again, talking with your kid, a lot of kids will be ready to come out to everyone and will want you to do it. And knowing if you want to do that, cool, you're both set. You can come out for them and everyone's ready to go. But I think there are a lot of parents who aren't ready when their kid is. And I think that you need to forgive yourself for that, because there's no reason to feel guilty about needing a little bit of time. And talking to your kid and being like, hey, I'm so happy for you and I'm so happy that you've included me, and I just need like a little bit of time to think about how I want to talk to your grandmother about it. I want just a little bit of time so that they know that you still support them, but that you need a little time to become more comfortable with how to talk about things and how to answer questions, because it's a process for you the same way it was a process for your kid. You know, your kid has come out, and now you, as a parent of a gay kid, you're coming out too. So forgiving yourself for needing time is really important, because I think, you know, your kid had time before they came out, and I think it's okay to take a little bit of time for yourself as well.
Okay, but what if we tell our friend or even, you know, a relative, and we get a negative reaction?
It's hard, but there will be cases when that will happen, and you have to be prepared for that. And I think two things to think about is that, first of all, people change and their minds change, and sometimes their immediate reaction is not how they really feel. They could come back to you in a week or a month or a year and say, I'm so sorry, I don't know why I reacted that way, or them knowing your kid could completely open up a new world for the way that they view the LGBTQ community. You know, they may have never seen it or never known anyone. And I think there will be cases where people are so firm in their beliefs and their stances that they won't want to associate with you and your family. And I think, honestly, like, it's better to not have them in your life. And I'm not saying, like, get rid of all your friends who don't like gay people. But, like, that's kind of, you know, it's like, why do you want someone in your life who's not going to support and unconditionally love you and your family and your kid especially, you know?
Danielle, say once a child comes out, how do you know if a friend is just a friend? I mean, should we ask?
I think so. I mean, I don't know how you would. That's the only way I would ever know. Because you can't try to assume. It's either going to go, you're going to assume everyone is a girlfriend, or you're going to assume everyone is just a friend. So I would say, sit your kid down and be like, here's the deal. You're going to want to have sleepovers. You're going to want to have your friends watching movies in your room with the door closed. And we're going to have a conversation, because I need you to be honest with me so that everyone can feel respected, and so that I know whether or not to refer to someone as a friend or a girlfriend.
Oh, I love that respected word.
Yeah.
What's the number one thing parents can do to support their child who has come out to them?
Continue to ask questions and talk about it. And giving them resources and making resources available to you. And if they want to, you know, go to a pride parade with you, or if they want to go to a community PFLAG, Parents and Friends of the LGBTQ community, if they want to go to a meeting with you, that's awesome. But it's so important to just keep that dialogue open and keep talking about it, because a lot of times parents will be like, it's cool. It's totally cool. Don't even care. And then they'll never say it again, and the kid feels a little bit dismissed.
Well, Danielle Owens-Reed, co-author of This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids, A Question and Answer Guide to Everyday Life, great information. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having me.
What does it take to be a successful award-winning author? One who is consistently developing a story that sells, intrigues, and leaves readers wanting more. Friends describe nonfiction author Deborah Davis's beat as the rich and the dead. She's uncovered fascinating aspects of the lives of Truman Capote, President Teddy Roosevelt, and Booker T. Washington, among others. And she wrote a 25-year retrospective on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Deborah Davis's curiosity and ability to hone in on unique stories is once again on display in her latest book, Fabricius and the Goldfinch. She joins us on the phone from New York City to talk about this book and the art of writing and getting published. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
Thank you so much.
You know, you're this award-winning author, and you keep churning out one great read after another. How do you come up with your ideas? They're all rather unique.
I think a good writer has to be a very, very curious person. And I'm always annoying everyone by asking way too many questions and saying, you know, that I really could be interested in absolutely anything. And I am interested in everything. So I just keep my eyes open and wait to get that little internal signal that says, ah, here's a book.
Well, once you have an idea then, do you draft an outline and then pitch it to the publishers? How does that even work?
It's really interesting with nonfiction writing, because if I were a novelist, I'd have to write the whole book and then present it to publishers. But when you're dealing with nonfiction, what you do is write a kind of extended pitch, you know, laying out what you think the book will be. Now, mind you, at this point in time, it's all speculation because you haven't done the research yet. So it's a miracle when what you propose turns out to be what ends up in the book. And in the best of all possible worlds, the book turns out to be more interesting than you ever imagined.
Well, what was your first book? And was it really hard to land that first deal with a publisher?
My first book was Strapless, the story of the John Singer Sargent painting Madame X, and it was surprisingly easy to get the publishing deal. And that's because a nonfiction story stands on its own. If it sounds like an interesting story, chances are, you know, you can get a publisher to back you, especially if the proposal is written in a lively and interesting way. I think it gets harder and harder because there are more and more books. and you can find a book about lobster. You can find a book about the color blue. You know, there are books that have been written just about everything. So it is a little trickier to find that subject that is unexplored.
Well, once you really kind of grab onto a subject, how long does it take you, just on average, if you had to come up with a number, to gather the details before you even put pen to paper?
I would say that it takes about a year. The biggest problem is forcing yourself to stop doing the research, because research is the most interesting part of any project. And there comes a moment when you realize, uh-oh, I better start writing. And you have to put the research aside. You can really get lost in it. It's like crack. You know, it's a very, very heady drug.
And so then when you start writing, does it just kind of flow?
Oh, no, only in movies.
It doesn't just pour out?
Flow is not the word I would use. You stare at that computer screen and you say, did I ever write anything before? How did I do it? Where did I start? It really is like doing it for the first time every time. And then just when you get good and, you know, you pick up speed and you feel like you're, you know, at full metal, the book is over. And it's time to put that one away and start from scratch, come up with a new topic, do the research, and start writing again. And I honestly always feel like it's the first day of school.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with award-winning author Deborah Davis about her own career as an author and best advice for those aspiring to walk in her shoes. Her latest book is called Fabricius and the Goldfinch. So, Deborah, how many hours a day do you dedicate to writing?
I sit all day long. I get up as if I were going to an office, and I do go to an office. It just happens to be in my house. I sit at my desk. And I could go all day and I could go all night. And as I get closer and closer to deadline, it's not a pretty picture. I feel sorry for my family. I ignore them. I wear schlumpy clothes. And there is nothing glamorous. There are no glasses of scotch and cigarette holders and you know, anything like that.
Well, I'm thinking it sounds like me and Kathy when we're working
like
on
us.
Scripts. We can totally relate.
We're artists, and, you know, that's what happens. But I think that what people who aspire to write have to keep in mind is that it's really not about writing, it's about rewriting. So you just have to get something, you know, my cat is black on the page, and then rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it. And that's where the artistry really comes in. Otherwise, you know, you might as well just be going to the salt mines. It's that, you know, unglamorous a job.
Well, Deborah, what happens if the words aren't flowing and you sort of have writer's block? Do you have any tricks that help you sort of keep those juices flowing?
Yes, of course. I go straight to the refrigerator.
Oh, I do that too, but with Doritos.
I think every writer who works at home will tell you that, you know, you'd think that there were golden pearls of wisdom in that refrigerator for the amount of time I spend standing in front of it. But I think that you just have to surrender and understand that it's a process, that it decides when it's coming. I mean, maybe this is where the concept of a muse came from. You do your best to control your writing, and sometimes it really is building blocks, but a lot of the time you just have to go with it and see where it takes you. And sometimes you can scrap a whole day's work, because when you look at it the next day, you realize, what was I thinking? This is terrible. But there are those moments when the words come together and all is good.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your latest work, Fabricius and the Goldfinch. How did you come up with this idea? And we know it's based on a painting by Carol Fabricius, which was painted in 1654. So how did you land this one?
Well, this bird, this painting, was on the tip of everybody's tongue last fall when Donna Tartt published her Pulitzer-winning book, The Goldfinch. And like thousands of other people, I read The Goldfinch. I devoured it. It has the painting on the cover, actually. And I wondered, she writes about this painting, she writes about this artist, but since her book is a novel, I wasn't entirely sure if Fabricius and the Goldfinch were real or if they were dramatic inventions. So as soon as I finished the book, I went straight to Google to look up, you know, the artist and the painting, and sure enough, they were real. And I thought, you know, other people are doing the same thing. They're really exploring these things that they picked up in the novel and wanting to know more about it. So I decided to write a book about it. And I discovered when I was doing my research that the real life story of Fabricius and his painting are every bit as interesting as Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. And it was really a story that needed to be told.
And we understand that there's lots of intrigue. We don't want to give anything away, but the painting was apparently lost and found over centuries. I mean, it's really got a lot of good stuff in it.
Well, this was one of those situations where there was much more than met the eye. I had no idea when I started my research, and I went to Holland. I really, you know, took it very seriously. I had no idea that the story was so large and varied and dramatic. And I've been told it's a funny thing because the book was published by Amazon. It's a Kindle single. And so, of course, there are, you know, many, many readers' comments. And some people say, read this before you read The Goldfinch. Others say, read this after you read The Goldfinch. And then there are some that say, don't bother reading The Goldfinch, just read this. So there's been, you know, quite a response to it. But it is, it's an hypnotic story. And the painting has become so famous now. It resides in Holland, but it was in America briefly. And it is a remarkable painting that really, really brings out very strong responses from people.
Well, Deborah Davis, author of Fabricius and the Goldfinch, among many other works, thanks so much for joining us, babes, and sharing some great insider tips for aspiring authors.
Thank you so much. My favorite show. Love being on it.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, what's on your travel bucket list? Stay with us because you might have to add a few more.
If you're lucky enough to cross off some destinations from your travel bucket list, after this, you'll surely need to add a few more. And if you haven't started your list, fear not, we have 1,000 ideas for you.
Patricia Schultz is the author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die, a traveler's life list. It's an international bestseller and Bible for the wanderlust stricken. Patricia joins us on the phone from New York City. Well, you are surely one well-traveled boomer babe. I am green with envy.
You know, I can't travel enough. I just came back. I already have my next many trips planned. There's always a suitcase open in my living room. So much to see and so little time. So I created this book as a kind of roadmap, or as the quintessential bucket list, if you may. So I did a whole lot of homework and did the work for you to a certain degree. And you were telling me before about how you use it as a go-to reference, kind of a travel Bible. And that was the very reason that that was my goal, my aim, to, you know, have people, you know, open their horizons and the possibilities.
How on earth could you possibly narrow down all the places in the world to just 1,000?
Well, I'm glad you said that because, you know, there are so many people, especially when I was researching it, and people would always ask, how would I ever find 1,000 people, as if I needed to kind of scramble and make up places just to fill the book. And in fact, when you think about the possibilities that are truly countless or daunting, the real challenge was to hone it down to just 1,000. And when I did the revision 2 years ago, I reorganized the book and I made it much tighter, so that by putting two or three of the original entries into one, and to create more of an itinerary or a kind of mini itinerary or a trail, I would then open the book up to hundreds of new places. But, you know, even then, there are so many that didn't quite make the cut. You know, the possibilities, you could live to be 1,000 years old and just barely scratch the surface.
So, Patricia, have you actually visited all of your recommendations?
I would say about 80%.
Wow, you must have some golden miles on the
I just did the math. That's 800 trips. Not bad.
Yeah, good math. The first book, I feel that by the time 10 years had passed, because it came out in 2003, I had pretty much seen almost all of them. And then when I did the revision a few years ago, I added so many places I had since heard about or stumbled upon or, you know, had heard about from friends who had just come back glowing, so that I now am kind of back to 80%. But I'm checking them off. I have my own wish list as well.
Well, Patricia, some of your choices aren't too surprising, like the Taj Mahal and Niagara Falls. Some not so obvious. So what was it about the pork pit in Montego Bay that just landed in on that list?
Well, some of these places are wonderful for what they are. And this is just a local institution where for generations, Jamaicans have been coming for some really, you know, roll up your sleeves and get messy kind of Jamaican jerk. It was the closest thing that I could hope a reader could find and walk away from it with a really authentic, quintessentially Jamaican experience, where you sit down at a picnic table outdoors with a local family, you make a toast with your Red Stripe beer bottle, have some great food for $1.50, and, you know, walk away thinking, well, that's why people love Jamaica. Great music, great hospitality, and just really, you know, grandma's recipe kind of jerk that you don't find in a five-star restaurant in America. So there are millions of these pork pits in the world. I wanted to find the best in Jamaica or the best of something similar in the south of France or the best, you know, third-generation family-owned restaurant in Florence, that kind of thing.
Well, we babes think there's nothing quite like a wonderful, relaxing beach vacation. So which one is on the top of your list?
Oh, that's such a loaded question, because there are beaches here in our backyard, you know, in the Mediterranean, in the Caribbean, because look how easy that is for the average American. Whether you live in Miami or you live in Detroit, you're always, you know, a direct flight away to any number. And some in the Caribbean, which have the most exquisite beaches, I always think of Anguilla. Kind of flat as a pancake, but beautiful hotels that are right on these really picture-perfect beaches. Bermuda, with those legendary pink sand beaches, is the sand really pink? Yeah, it is. That always amazed me. Something further afield, you know, for an occasion, or if you live on the West Coast in California, it's more, manageable, or is French Polynesia, which is every bit as exotic and you know, exquisite as you see those Gauguin paintings to be. Bora Bora, James Michener said it was the most beautiful island in the world. So there's no shortage of islands in this book, that's for sure.
I wanted to ask you about traveling by train, which, you know, people see, which I think is like the ultimate romantic adventure, except not on Amtrak, I have to add. So can you tell us about a train trip that made your list?
When people say, what is your favorite trip, I commonly say, because it's so true, is the one I just came back from. And in fact, that unpacked suitcase that's in my living room that I mentioned is from a trip I just made to southern Spain, to Andalusia, on a beautiful vintage train. It's 100 years old, and it was built for the British royal family, who used it. They would cross the English Channel, then get on this train in the north of France and train on down to Provence in the French Riviera. So it was just neglected and abandoned, and the Spanish government purchased it, rehabbed it, refurbished it, and it is beautiful. And for 1 week it leaves from Seville, and it does this loop around Andalusia. So it does all of those great cities like Cordoba and Granada, and you see the dancing Andalusian horses. It really was a magical week, and the train is called Al Andalus. Al-Andalus. And it also does another train across northern Spain, Basque country, San Sebastian, Bilbao, where that wonderful Guggenheim Museum is, and it winds up in Santiago de Compostela. So, and then there's, of course, the mother of them all is the Orient Express from London to Venice, and then once a year it continues on to Istanbul. And there's, the Rocky Mountaineer in western Canada. Have you heard of that one? It goes through the beautiful Canadian Rocky Mountains into some of their most beautiful parks.
Oh, sounds gorgeous. Patricia Schultz, author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die, A Traveler's Life List. We babes have a lot of trips to book. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
For more than three decades, Vincent Bowles, a retired two-star general, served his country leading young men and women into combat. Following the attacks of 9/11, he was assigned to command soldiers, civilians, and contractors on five continents, including combat in Operation Iraqi Freedom.
General Vincent Bowles knows what it means to be a leader in the workplace and on the front lines. He shares his insights and life lessons in his book, 4-3-2-1 Leadership, and he joins us today from Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome, General.
Thank you so much, and it's great to be here.
Well, you write that when you joined the Army, it wasn't because you felt a calling to become a general, but it was actually your plan B. So I can't imagine what your plan A was. Do tell us.
Well, my father's plan A, my dad was an immigrant from Ireland, he and my mom. And he came to New York City in the very, very early 1950s, 1950, I believe. And he started out, basically, if you remember the TV show Flip This House, my dad was into Flip This Bar and Restaurant in New York City and Manhattan and other places around the city. And at one point, he had about six places or so around the city. And at about the age of 10, I started working for him, and I was the oldest of four boys. And one day when I was 16, I was mopping the floor for about the 300th time. And my father looked at me over the bar and said, you know, someday this will all be yours.
Were you like, I don't think so? Or
under my breath, I said, dear God, I got to get plan B. I mean, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's not going to be this. And my dad was wonderful. I never met anybody who worked harder. And he always took care of us as a family and everything else. But I just said, you know, I don't know if this is my life's dream.
Oh.
And so I went to Niagara University to college up in Niagara Falls. And I ran into an ROTC instructor. I was a history major at the time. And he said, you know, we got a military history course. If you take it, we'll give you credit for it. And I took the course, and I genuinely liked it. And the next thing, they turned around and offered me a scholarship for my last 2 years of college. And things went on from there.
So was that kind of the turning moment when you realized the Army was your cup of tea?
I didn't realize the Army was my cup of tea in terms of a career. I knew it was a cup of tea to get me away from the bar and restaurant business for 4 years.
Well, Vinny, you write that from early on, you were intrigued by the connection that effective leaders establish with those they lead. So what exactly do you mean?
Management is directive. I like to tell people when I talk, management is a clipboard and a task list. And it's directive and it's task-oriented and it's getting certain things done by a certain time to a certain standard. And that's directive in nature. Leadership is how you get that done. And leadership is connective. How do you forge that connection with those you lead so that they want to lead you and you take enough time to want to forge and make that connection to not be the boss, but be their boss? And that's really where I come at it from. You have to take the time to make that connection and understand what their expectations are.
So what's the secret ingredient that makes the difference between success and failure as a leader?
The great news is there's no secret. Leadership is not terribly complicated, but it is really hard. And it's hard because you have to be persistent and consistent to be a good leader. You can't walk in and say to your staff, hey, Tuesdays, Thursdays are my leadership days. The rest of the time, too bad to be you. You have to be a consistent, persistent leader. And really, folks want to see if you're going to walk your talk. And if you'll be a values-based, standards-driven leader and be consistent with how you apply those standards and be patient when bad news comes, folks will genuinely follow you.
If you just tuned in, we're talking with General Vincent Bowles about what it takes to be an effective leader. His book is called 4-3-2-1 Leadership, What America's Sons and Daughters Taught Me on the Road from Second Lieutenant to Two-Star General. Well, you say that America's sons and daughters have taught you some really great lessons about leadership. So let's talk about a few of those lessons specifically. First, you say teams need leaders. So are you kind of saying that maybe group consensus is not the way to go?
The reason we need leaders is every rule doesn't apply every time in every situation to every person. So we need leaders for judgment. Where group consensus is helpful is when you've got to get everybody working who have different interests and different value systems, and you're not in charge of everybody, like our political process we have going on now. You need to have consensus. But when I find the less time you have, and when the heat's high and the pressure's on and the outcome's uncertain, as combat often is and as very intense operations usually are, folks really don't want consensus. They want a leader to emerge who'll quickly generate that consensus, generate the critical information he or she needs, and move out and make a decision. And folks have an expectation that you'll decide.
And then next you talk about the importance of recognizing stress in teams and finding solutions along with balance. So how do you go about doing that?
I had a great guy I worked with. We were fellow colonels together and then fellow one-star and two-star generals together. And he said something that resonated with me. He said, we were out in a training deployment, and he said, look, there's only two reasons for stress in this operation. I know something you don't know, or you know something I don't know. And if we keep the communication lines open enough to sort that out, we'll be okay. And time again, when I reflected on stressful situations or organizations that had been stressed, I found out that the reason stress occurs in an organization is because the organization knows what it's supposed to be doing, and they realize they're not doing it. They know what the value systems are. They know what the purpose statement is on the bulletin board, on the corporate flyers and everything else, and they realize that on a day-in, day-out basis, they're not living up to that, and they're not performing in that way. And when you look at some of the tragedies we had in our Army over the last decade, the Abu Ghraib situation, the Pat Tillman situation, Walter Reed and its tragedies there, it wasn't because we had the wrong values. It was because we let those values go at the exact critical time we needed to cling even more closely to them. So stress occurs in organizations when people know what they're supposed to be doing and they're not doing it, and there's not a viable vehicle for them to tell senior leadership, hey, this isn't working.
Well, I was just going to ask you, do you think people are reluctant to come forward and say, look, it's not working, or I'm completely stressed out, we need to find a different way?
They are, and I find that's one of two reasons. One is it's a real fear. Somebody else has done that before, and the boss has reached under the table, pulled out a flamethrower, and taken them out. So they go, okay, my desire to do that's marginal. Or the other reason is they talk themselves into, well, you know you can never tell the truth around here because you know what they'll do to you. And then you say, well, who were they? And they go, well, they're hiding and they're really sneaky, but they're out there. So sometimes we become our own worst enemies by buying into that. But often it's because they've seen or they've got a perception that you can't be straight with senior leaders. And for that reason, I often, when I talk to audiences, I have senior leaders, corporate leaders ask me, what is one of the most critical skills I need to develop? And I say one of the most critical skills you need to develop is how you take bad news.
Well, Vinny, then you say there is absolutely one non-negotiable in effective leadership, trust. So why is that the most critical component?
You can't predict every situation you're going to put your employees in, your workers in, yourself in, your soldiers in, your sailors in. You can't predict every situation. The enemy does get a vote, whether it's in the corporate sector or on the battlefield. But what you can predict is that if they believe they can trust your instincts and trust your judgment, and that you'll be looking out for them and you will maintain a mission focus and take care of them, if they can trust that you'll do that, they will follow you. If they perceive that you won't do that, they'll listen to you, but they'll be looking for somebody else to trust and somebody else to follow as quickly as they can.
And Vinny, is there a leadership mistake that you have made along the way where you say, ooh, boy, I wish I had done that differently?
Oh, yes. I'm sure if I got all my subordinates in, they'd say, yeah, more than a couple. But I remember one I made once. I had an officer that worked for me, and it was just one of those things. If I said yes, he said no. If I said blue, he said red. I mean, whatever it was, I knew if I was going to say something at the conference table and eyes were going to roll and heads were going to shake, it was going to be him. And this went on for about 14, 15 months. And I tried to fix it, tried to work with it, tried to be patient and everything else, and it just didn't connect. Now, let me be clear, he didn't do anything illegal, unethical, immoral, unsafe. It's just we wouldn't have made a good married couple. It just didn't connect. And for whatever reason, and I tried mightily, and then one day he looked over at me, he said, you know, you don't get how important I am, and you don't appreciate what I can do for this organization. And God help me, I snapped inside. And when I snap, I don't rant and rave and scream. I just get very, very quiet. And I looked at him, I said, you're exactly right. And I have searched my heart as hard as I can. And I don't know what else to do. So I've done everything I can do. From now on, we have a problem, and the problem's your problem. You better figure out how to sort it out. I didn't sleep that night. The next morning, I came into work, and it was like he was reborn. He was perky, cheery, everything else. And I finally looked over at my great command sergeant major, my head sergeant that was working with me, and I said, what just happened over there? And he said, when you confronted him, you took his excuse away. You told me he didn't have an excuse anymore. Yeah, there was a problem, and now it was his problem, and you weren't going to be bothered with it anymore, and he had to go figure it out. He said, sir, for 14, 15 months, you've been letting this eat you up and tear you up. He said, if you'd done that after about 4 or 5 months, we'd be a lot better off right now. So what I realized is sometimes you have to search your heart, do the best you can, and then say, look, I'm doing the best I can. And at a certain point in time, you may have to admit defeat. I didn't want to admit defeat in that. I was absolutely convinced I could, quote, turn him, sell him, get him over to my side of the fence. And at a certain point in time, I finally came to the realization I couldn't.
Who do you consider to be the best leader today in corporate America?
There are a number, but I would have to say the person that I think makes the best combination of values, vision, and adherence to those things, the one that stands out most to me is Fred Smith at FedEx. When you think about how he started, Marine in Vietnam, then went to Ivy League business school, came up in the 70s with the FedEx concept, and I think the rumors vary around, but he got somewhere between a C plus or a B minus on the paper. And his instructor kind of looked at him like, that'll never fly, no pun intended. And then to see that he turned it around and in the 80s had it as a viable entity, and now, God, it's a worldwide, you know, FedEx has just become a verb. You know, people, you're going to FedEx that. You know, just think about that. And through it all, he has maintained his values, and a Vietnam veteran, tremendous individual, and has been able to transition those values that he learned into the corporate sector and had a very viable operation there.
Well, General Vincent Bowles, leadership expert and author of 4321 Leadership, What America's Sons and Daughters Taught Me on the Road from Second Lieutenant to Two-Star General. Thanks so much for sharing your leadership lessons with the two Boomer Babes.
Well, ladies, thank you so much. I was just privileged to be on a lot of great teams with a lot of great folks who just took very good care of me, and it's just a great country to serve.
When that alarm goes off each morning, does your mind automatically start racing through all the things you must get done that day on your ever-expanding to-do list? Probably by the time you're out the door, you're already exhausted, not to mention stressed out. Sound familiar?
Barb Schmidt, international speaker and author of The Practice, says there's a better, more mindful way to approach and embrace each day through meditation. She joins us on the phone to shoot the breeze about Meditation 101. Why is it so important to start the day with meditation?
The importance is that you're connecting with you first. You're launching into your day without connecting to you, so you're at the mercy of all the things that are happening in the external world. And when you wake up and spend time with you first, really connect with your body and your mind and your spirit and your heart, the chances of you handling all those crazy things that happen throughout the day are so much greater with a peaceful, more present mind and attitude with what happens throughout your day. So it sets the tone for the whole day.
So how do we actually meditate?
Meditation is really about just sitting with yourself. The Buddhists call meditation a sitting. So you sit with yourself, not to stop the thinking, because the mind thinks, that's what it does. You sit with yourself to not engage the thoughts or not to push the thoughts away, to just be. Pick an object. You pick the breath. You pick a mantra. You pick a phrase or a passage or a prayer to bring your mind back to. So when I sit in my quiet space, legs don't have to be crossed. You can sit in a chair with your hands just gently in your lap. Close your eyes just like a baby closes their eyes really gently, beautifully. And just let the thoughts start coming, because they're going to come. But put your mind's eye attention on your breath. Let's just use that as the object. So as the thought comes, I'm going to bring my attention back to the breath. As the thought comes, I'm going to bring it back to the breath. So instead of engaging the thought, I'm hungry, I want something to eat, instead of saying, oh, okay, I think I'll go make breakfast, no, you just acknowledge the thought came, and then you let it go. You do that for 5 minutes every day. You're connecting within to your deep source of strength, of power, of love, of compassion. Then you go into your day, and you really can come back to that peace that you've established by sitting with yourself for that 5 minutes throughout your day and into the night.
Well, Barb, how do we quiet our minds?
Picture yourself sitting in quiet by yourself for 5 minutes in the morning. So you don't make the peace happen. The peace just comes. Assuming the stance of least resistance is what I always teach. So you just sit there, and as you're not engaging thought, and you're not really doing anything, you're just bringing your attention back to your breath, the peace comes. It comes amidst all the crazy thoughts that are coming in the brain. So you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you've established this ability to be able to let things go, to let the thoughts come and go, to let the worries come and go. Now, this takes practice. That's why I call it the practice. But you've established that routine and that ability so you know that you can come back to that in the evening. So if I wake up in the middle of the night stressed or worried about something, I close my eyes, I take some deep breaths, I put my attention on my breath, I might repeat my mantra or a little phrase or a prayer, and instantly I'm feeling tired and go back to sleep. It's the engaging of the thought or the worry or the anxiety that causes the disruption in our mind, in our bodies, and in our beings to start wanting to take an action.
Well, what's an example of your mantra or a mantra?
An example of a mantra that I teach from all the ancient traditions is a holy phrase or a hallowed word. Mahatma Gandhi's mantra was Rama, Rama, Rama. My mantra, St. Francis of Assisi, used this prayer phrase, my God and my all. So it's a hallowed phrase or word that has a lot of power and connection to those masters, teachers, mystics, traditions, and saints that use them before us. And as you practice it, it's an amazing tool, very spiritual, very deep, but it's an amazing tool that brings your mind back to the present moment and anchors you within.
Is there a best place to meditate? Because I'm thinking if I'm sitting in the middle of my family room, I'm going to look around and I'm going to think to myself, this is such a mess. I have to clean it up and it's going to be very stressful and it won't help my meditation. So where should we meditate?
Meditate someplace that's quiet, certainly, but that doesn't have the distractions that you're talking about mentally and physically, like a television or a computer or a kitchen stove and a sink, because your mind will automatically get wrapped up in wanting to do. So find a place that's quiet, the corner of your bedroom or the corner of a guest room or some place that doesn't have that physical and mental attachment to it. And just go there every single day. The mind and the body starts to quiet down as you start a practice like this. When I start walking to my meditation space, which is the corner of my guest bedroom, my mind automatically just says, okay, I'm going to be meditating now, so we're going to be quiet. It's really a routine and a habit that you can start forming where it really helps greatly to quiet the mind.
Barb Schmidt, author of The Practice, thanks so much for giving us, babes, some meditation tips. We really have some work to do.
Really been a joy to be here and talk with you both today.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.